Welcome to the Real Vision Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Real Vision Daily Briefing. It's Thursday, October 14, 2021. I'm Ash Bennington, joined today by our own Jack Farley. Lots to talk about. Earnings come in hotter than expected. Bank stocks are surging. And there's talk again, chatter, more data about shortage in the labor market. Jack Farley, welcome back.
Great to be here, Ash.
Great to have you as always. Jack, what are you looking at right now?
Well, I think it would have to be earnings season. It began in full on Monday. And since then, I think something like 20 companies have reported and all but two of them have posted earnings beats. That's the actual earnings per share is higher than the number. A few standouts today. Walgreens was up 6% because it absolutely blew it out of the water. Delta Airlines is actually making money now again. If you can believe it. The big banks are reporting what on the surface are great numbers. All big beats, huge record revenues, record net incomes. But there is some stuff beneath the surface, like slowing loan growth. That I don't like in particular. Oh, I mean, I guess today's an everything rally, Ash. The S&P, Ash, you tell me how much, you tell me how much the S&P 500 is up, because every single sector is up. It's not only up, it's up more than 1%. With the exception of consumer discretionary, which is up 99 basis points, but I'm rounding up. Today's a roundup day.
Yes, indeed. It's up 1.71%, settling down here. Looks like we got a final number at 4,438.22. On the S&P 500. By the way, it looks like the big winner of the day is actually not the S&P, it's the NASDAQ up fractionally higher, 1.73%, closing out the day at 14,823. Jack, you mentioned banks. Let's talk about financial services. Tell us what you're seeing there in a little more detail.
Well, Ash, the good news is there's a continued frenetic activity in mergers and acquisitions, in capital markets raising, issuing bonds, issuing equity. That is arguably the hottest it's ever been. So that is a total growth engine for the banks, and that is why you're seeing green on the screen. The bad news, Ash, is actually, it's slowing loan growth, and this is something that banks have struggled with historically. They're just not lending their money out. They're making money other ways and perhaps, sort of new ways like, you have stocks, Ash, and I'll lend money to you securitized by that stock. But in terms of like, you want to start a business, we're going to lend to you that sort of simple old school style business. That is not happening.
Yeah, C&I lending, commercial and industrial lending, the backbone of the U.S. retail economy. Certainly that chart demonstrates that. I'm always interested when earnings come out, and I'm not sure if you have an opinion on this, Jack, but it's always fun to do the compare and contrast among the banks. Who are the leaders? Who are the laggards? Based on the chart I believe you just showed, what we're seeing here is it seems like JPMorgan Chase bucking the trend and seeing accelerating loan growth, particularly relative to other players in the space. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, let's actually put these charts up right now. This is the total 1 year growth in deposits. So you take deposits right now, you compare what was deposits a year ago, and you take the difference. You can see that deposits absolutely exploded higher starting during the coronavirus, 20%, 25%, 35% year-over-year growth in deposits. That is not normal, needless to say. And I think it's a result of two factors. The first is that the country was awash in liquidity because of the Federal Reserve. And the second was that, people's incomes were actually high and personal saving as a percentage of income was extraordinarily high, which no one expected in February and March of 2020, but it actually did prove to be a fact. Since then, it's moderated somewhat, 20%, 15%, 6% respectively for JP Morgan, Bank of America, and Citigroup, but still well above normal levels. So all the money is coming into the bank on the, let's say, the left side of the balance sheet. But on the right side, the liability side, you're actually loan growth. Actually, I should say, sorry, total deposits is itself a liability for banks, and loans are a asset for banks in the same way that they are a liability to regular people like you and me. But okay, so total loans actually has declined, and this is very interesting. I didn't get a chance to put Wells Fargo up there, but Wells Fargo has also declined precipitously. And pretty much, they're not lending. You can see Bank of America is still down year over year, 2%. Citigroup, very anemic growth, 79 basis points growth. And JP Morgan is actually the rare one that is actually starting to lend again.
Well, that's absolutely right, Jack. That's what the chart shows, and a very clear explanation. I should say, I'm sorry, Jack. I thought you had already shown those charts. It came up on my monitor. But to that point, talking about these charts, it is very interesting. As you point out, of course, the assets on bank balance sheets are their loan book. If those assets continue to decelerate, that does not bode well for future earnings for banks. As you point out, JP Morgan, the leader, and if you look at the price action here on the day, I'm looking at Wells Fargo, clearly the laggard, looks like minus 1.59, and Bank of America having a very great reaction today by investors in U.S. equity markets, up 4.5% on the day.
Yeah, I think so far the banks that have really led the charge were investment banks and trading shops that could make money based on M&A and trading and sort of that high finance stuff. We'll remain to see what will happen to the model of taking in deposits and lending it out. I was speaking to someone recently, actually. I didn't ask permission to say their name, so I won't. But they were saying that, you know, the banking industry is a little bit of a dinosaur. And this is actually, I was not talking to someone my age who's really into crypto, who has sort of a, you know, doesn't like the banks. Like, this is someone who, you know, has worked in the banking industry for a long time.
Yeah, you know, you make an interesting distinction there between these two different sort of sets, the Goldman Morgan Stanley view. By the way, Morgan Stanley up 2.46% on the day, talking about the distinction between banks that are generally retail banks and those that have large trading books, large FIC businesses, fixed income currencies and commodities. Jack, maybe we should do a show and call it Low Finance.
Low Finance? I like it.
Yeah, Low Finance. There's a little bit of a ring to it.
For sure. Ash, I think earnings seasons is in full swing. Banks started out strong, at least on the high number. But Wells Fargo, strong number. Morgan Stanley, $2.04 relative to $1.69. Citigroup, $2.15 relative to $1.78. So far, a lot of strength. But Ash, I think, and this is, I should say, my own opinion, we are definitely past phase one. And I'm using a framework that Annika Trajan, a financier in Europe, was telling me about. But phase one is the market is awash in liquidity. We're risk on. You know, I mean, yeah, sure. You know, Carnival Cruises lost $1 billion last quarter. But, like, you know, everything's going to be okay. We're definitely past phase one, where the market is excusing. Or, like, we're definitely in the show me phase, where it's time to show me the earnings. And by the way, I should mention JP Morgan buoyed today by the good news in the banks. Yesterday was actually down on what was a very good quarter. And by the way, their loan growth is actually the best in breed. So, you know, it's hard to sort of make sense of it all, like, and take a clean narrative. It's pretty complicated.
Well, Jack, we're looking at raw data here. We're looking at things that are coming right off the top of the tape, trying to parse this here in real time, and going through that analysis is always a helpful process. Best in breed, I suppose that's true, but you could also, I guess, if you wanted to be cynical, say, I wonder if, you know, there's potential they're taking on greater exposure than other banks. Hypothetically, we don't know this, of course, just a hypothetical question. While JP Morgan loan growth is growing, have they gotten, do they have superior insights, data, process in place on their underwriting side that allows them to make loans that are that they believe have a lower potential to default? Are they reserving against them in equal measure? There are a lot of complexities beneath the surface. And boy, we'd really love to have a banking expert on to talk about it. We could get, like, Chris Whalen back to do the deep dive, to go through bank by bank and understand and unpack.
We do, Ash. I'm no banking expert, but I do have a chart that is pretty insightful about what you just said. This is actually JP Morgan's loan book, one-year growth historically. Because I said, JP Morgan, they're leading the charge now. What have they did historically? Were they, you know, lending a lot during 2005, 6, 7? I actually had a hunch the answer was no, because I've seen interviews with Jamie Dimon saying that he was, you know, in as early as 2006, calling people and pulling credit lines and being very defensive. And you see that they were headlong, they rushed headlong into the subprime bonanza and private equity, whatever you want to call it, in 2004, 2005. But in 2006, 2007, they were very they had their hands on the reins. They were very conservative, and then they were allowed to take advantage of that in 2008, 2009 by lending a lot. So let's put that chart down. So that just goes to show I don't want to say it's all Jamie Dimon, and Jamie Dimon knows where the markets is headed, whatever. But I mean, I think he is a very competent person. But I think that, I wouldn't bet against the House of Morgan. That's what I'm saying.
But Jack, doesn't that chart suggest exactly the opposite, that their growth of loans accelerated as the subprime prices was just beginning to gear up? It's like a biphasic chart there. You see that first peak, 2000, looks like 2004, 2005. Then you see some of that, as you say, hand on the reins. And then 2008, 2009, just as the financial crisis is brewing on the horizon, you see a dramatic acceleration in their loan growth. I guess this is year over year, prior quarter. It looks like they did begin to dial it down, I guess, before the worst of the crisis. But you know, maybe this suggests a bit of epistemic humility for all senior management at banks and risk management. It's not an easy thing to do. If it were, anyone could do it.
Definitely not. Ash, I have a slightly different read of the chart. From my readings of 2008, I think the real manure in the subprime category was created in early 2006 and 2007. And so I actually think they got out at exactly the right time. I see they were going headlong in 2004, 2005. That historically was actually a very good time to be in the mortgage business, as you know. And as a matter of fact, this is a story I heard from our good friend Max Wheathy, that he was talking, he was at a nightclub or something like that, and it was a good night. Max was saying, "Oh, this is a good night," you know? And he said, "Yeah, but we still haven't had so business is good now, but it hasn't been as good as it was in 2006," referring to all of the Wall Street bankers and traders who had incredible bonuses that ultimately led the global economy astray.
I love Max as a leading indicator with nightclub experiences. Jack, you can make even the word manure sound classy when you say it. I am curious, though. I mean, obviously, you see the deceleration, though, that going negative, the flipping below the origin line at zero, where you see that contraction. So I don't know. I guess you could argue to what extent the bad loans had been made across the board and were already securitized. Open question, something we should definitely deep dive on here more at Real Vision and on the Real Vision Daily Briefing. That'd be a great topic to cover.
Definitely. Ash, the other thing I want to talk about is the labor shortage, which I think has received ample coverage in the mainstream media and business press. But I think it really, maybe 3 months ago, it wasn't, impacting businesses and margins and securities as much as they are now. Like, I just saw two stories today. Number one, 10,000 workers at Deere, John Deere, are going on strike because they couldn't get the right deal that they wanted with United Auto Workers. And then Domino's Pizza announced a 1.9% contraction in same-store sales because that they said they were pressured by a very challenging staffing environment. Now, could it be that they just didn't deliver and it has nothing to do with workers and then they're just using that as an excuse? Of course. I'm not on the ground in the pizza kitchen, but I'm seeing a lot of stories about, this is real. This is no longer just like a societal issue. This will impact businesses' profitability because they just can't get the right number of people. So become priced in the stocks, and that is a risk to equity prices for sure.
Did you seriously just say Domino's didn't deliver?
I did, but I didn't realize the pun until you said it.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called PI, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
All right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's,
trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Welcome back to Real Vision's Daily Briefing. Let's get right back to the top analysis of today's markets.
All right, away from bad puns, I wanted to hit some data points on this because I think it brings into focus precisely the points that you were bringing up during those two stories about Domino's and Deere. New applications for unemployment benefits fell to 293,000. This is the first time since the pandemic that they're below 300,000. So obviously an encouraging sign there, but still elevated versus the 2019 new applications for unemployment numbers. I will say this also to sort of come back full circle to the point that you were making earlier about the multiple phases of this recovery. S&P 500 today up the most since March.
Oh, wow. Really? Yeah. I mean, full risk on day. And Ash, the gains, the Jubilee is not limited to the equity market. We're having a good day in crypto too, right?
We are, as we frequently have these last week to 10 days here. Let's just go through a quick rundown on some of these numbers. Bitcoin right now at 57,542. Ethereum at 3,776. So obviously these are numbers that that are looking up near, you know, certainly their 30-day or so highs, I think it's fair to say. Obviously, I'm looking at the chart here a little bit longer term. We saw those record highs in April at 62,000-63,000 on the Bitcoin side. By the way, Jack, let me throw this out there. Here's something that came out from the crypto flow, news flow today, which is that Coinbase is suggesting, has come out with a position paper where they recommend that DMAs, these are the digital marketplace for assets. This is, I guess, their new term of art for folks in their business, the Coinbases, the Krakens of the world. They're basically recommending a new regulator to oversee the entire cryptocurrency space here in the U.S. Obviously, Coinbase, Kraken, others would like that kind of regulatory certainty. And by the way, it would probably be great for them to put some more moats in place. But this is something that I think is really interesting as this space begins to transition, as you were sort of suggesting, Jack, into something that looks a lot more mainstream and feels in many ways more like a typical regulated brokerage environment.
Yeah, that's very interesting, Ash. You know, there's DeFi, there's crypto, and then there's the metaverse. I think that Raoul had a conversation with a guest on the metaverse that was very interesting to me.
Yeah, let's take a look. This actually comes to us. This is a conversation with Raoul, Raoul's Adventures in Crypto. It's Raoul with Vatsal Brawford. It's from the Exponential Age, I should say, actually here on the Essential tier. Let's take a look right now.
You can exist in a physical world, yet there'll be digital objects around you.
Right.
And digital enhancements, we kind of understand the enhancements that your phone can help you out. But you can physically, so you could have your NFT art displayed on the wall that you don't see in the physical space, but you see it in the digital space by, you know, you pick up your phone and suddenly it reveals things or what. I mean, that's an extraordinary world where physical and digital are real properties, as you talked about.
There you have it, our own Raoul Powell on the Exponential Age with Vatsal Broadwatch. You know, I thought that was an interesting clip talking about this this kind of hybrid world where the physical and the digital both merge into almost compatible or sort of coterminous, co-reference assets in a broader real asset space. Kind of a fascinating thought, isn't it, Jack?
Yeah, definitely. I'll be honest, Ash, that is a lot over my head. But I think if I heard some talk about Bitcoin or Ethereum in 2015, it would have been way over my head now. Whereas now, sort of the macro case for Bitcoin is like, oh yeah, 25 million, like central bank sheet. Yeah, like we all know this, right? So I think what's that's being said now is, you know, could become common knowledge in a few years. But now definitely over the heads of a lot of people, including myself.
Yeah, you know, I just took it as basically talking about how this world where, you know, it's very distinct. Even here at Real Vision, right? We have the Real Vision platform and we have the Real Vision crypto platform. It's very much been a case where we've seen this divided universe between digital assets and macro assets, capital market assets. My take on Raoul's view on this is that he's talking about what the world starts to look like as those two begin to merge. And obviously, as we know, Raoul has had a great love affair with NFTs. He's doing some amazing work here on the Real Vision platform, talking about NFTs, talking about the metaverse. So a perfectly natural place probably for him to begin to frame that out, that case, that thesis for how those worlds may begin to unite and how those asset classes can start to come together, Jack.
Yeah, definitely. Ash, where do you want to take this? Because we talked about the labor shortage. We can talk commodities. We can go anywhere.
Jack, you got the car keys, man. You're driving. You tell me.
All right, let's talk about commodities. I think a month ago, month and a half ago, as Evergrande's demise was becoming apparent to us, a lot of people in the media, including myself, thought that that was going to really take the gas, pun intended, not intended, out of the commodity rally, which already was faltering going into August. In fact, you know, puts were bought against copper miners. You know, you sold your oil. You obviously got to get out of coal. We've seen the exact opposite. It's just been taken from level 10 to level 12. WTI front month contract is now above $80, the first time since 2014. Things are getting very, very hot. And people are actually now saying that this is unsustainable. And this is something that it was always hard for me to wrap my head around, which is, you know, $80 oil. That's great for if you produce oil. Of course it is. But it is, in a sense, contractionary on economy, because if you have to pay $5 at the gallon, you're going to consume less gas, and then that will have ripple effects throughout the economy. So I think that high commodity prices are good for a very small selection of equities, but overall, it doesn't really benefit anyone but them.
Well, and of course, the folks who are trading it, CLI won WTI oil on NYMEX front month trading right now, 81 spot 44. You know, Jack, a story that I saw, and I'm not sure if this is one that you're following, but let's talk what's happening in LNG, liquid natural gas. I'm looking at the chart right now. This is the generic front month for LNG on NYMEX. And what I see is, like, it's just an absolute hockey stick going from, it looks like, sub $3 over the last, call it 10 months up to, well, trading right now at $5.68. That is a dramatic, dramatic increase. I know that there are some real-world concerns around liquid natural gas shortages in Europe, potentially during what has been predicted to be a very cold winter. Are you following that story? And if so, any thoughts?
Not super closely, but I just was looking at a chart of LNG. And if you put it, liquefied natural gas, if you put it on a one-year chart, on a five-year chart, it looks exponential. But if you put it on a 20-year chart, you realize that we're nowhere close to the highs. I mean, I think the high was something like, you know, close to $16 in 2005. So things may seem absurd now, but they can get a lot more absurd. And also, I think that we got to tie this back to inflation, which is, you know, I mean, the poster child of inflation is expensive gas at the pump, expensive, food at the superstore, supermarket. And, you know, I think for a long time, Ash, people have been saying, oh, well, you know, inflation was 5.2%. But if you take out energy and food, you know, that's called core inflation, and that's only 4%. And then if you take out used cars and you take out airline tickets, then it's actually only 3.3%. So actually, there's nothing to worry about. I think that inflation, that argument made a lot of sense 6 months ago. I think it increasingly is making less sense, and it could perhaps become a political issue as we approach elections in the U.S. in November. And by the way, not just U.S., Europe, South Korea, even Japan, which is, you know, huge deflation, the rate of deflation is itself going down. So it could see some technical inflation in Japan too soon.
Jack, you sound like a crusty old school trader. Were you like on the desk trading LNG back in 2001?
No, but I recently was talking to a lot of people who are worried about inflation. So that definitely colors your view. You know, if I spent a lot of my time talking to people about decentralized finance, I'm sure I would, you know, be as Raoul would say, you know, finding cash between my cushions to buy more. Like, you know, I speak to some oil traders, some people who are worried about inflation. So yeah, gold, oil, that's sort of what my bias, if you can call it.
Yeah, one of the things that I saw on the Bloomberg terminal today, that was a gentleman named Edward Harrison, who had a great line saying, "Put away the disco ball. We're not headed towards stagflation. In fact, the more likely scenario is deflation. So all of these sort of multiple competing sort of variables, domains of frame of reference, thinking about commodities, thinking about growth, thinking about the job market, all competing, a lot of different scenarios out there, a lot of different macro theses that are floating around in terms of the way people are thinking about growth, about inflation, and about deflationary risk.
Yeah, I think for decelerating growth, the argument is pretty simple. If you get a rate of growth of 10% GDP growth, almost by definition, it's not sustainable. Further, to not be a decelerating rate, you'd have to continue and go higher and higher and higher. You know, there's only so far you can go. And when you have 10% GDP, pretty rarefied air. Likewise, if retail sales is growing 30% year over year, is it a contraction if it goes down to 22%? I guess technically, yes. But also, that is remarkable growth. So I think a lot of intelligent economists are using two-year rates of growth, because I think COVID just messed everything up, because it's base effects. If people have heard that term, it's March 2020, the CPI was very low. So then in March 2021, inflation CPI is going to be a very high rate of change. Likely we're getting over those base effects now. So actually, I think base effects no longer excuses the high rate of CPI. We're living in an inflationary world, and I think it's the deflationists who have something to prove, not the inflationists.
Very interesting. Very interesting take, Jack.
Yeah, I'm a polemicist, Ash. I just have sharing my opinions left and right, right?
Well, Jack, in addition to being a polemicist, you're also a storyteller. I understand that you have some news you'd like to share with us.
Yes, I do, Ash. Well, I have some news that actually today is going to be my last day hosting the Daily Briefing.
So, obviously, Jack, you've been a huge part of the Real Vision Daily Briefing from the very beginning when we built this show to serve viewers' needs, to try and get a sense of what was happening during the darkest days of the COVID crisis. In fact, I think we have a photograph of your first day on the Real Vision Daily Briefing, March 30th, 2020.
Yeah. All right. I assume the photo is up now. I had a lot more hair.
I think we all did before this crisis, Jack.
Yeah, definitely. Well, so yeah, just to be clear, I know I was very terse in my remarks. I am moving on shortly from Real Vision. So yeah, this is it. This is my final daily briefing. I'll be doing an interview tomorrow, which will air sometime next week. But then, yeah, I am moving on. And so I just want to say, Ash, I'm so grateful to Real Vision, to Ral, to you, to everyone who works at Real Vision. I mean, there's so many people who have just made this place a fantastic place to work and a fantastic place to learn. So I'm not going to even try and name them, but I'm also incredibly grateful to the guests who have been enormously generous with their time and insights. I mean, speaking to people who really have been working in this industry in 20 years and have counseled some people who are like CEOs and like the biggest hedge fund managers in the world, and as well as hedge fund managers. And they're just so willing to share their knowledge. So I'm very grateful to them. But most of all, I'd say I'm grateful to the Real Vision subscribers who've made all this possible, who've been with us thick and thin, who are also finance nerds here to learn. They're not necessarily here to watch a 5-minute interview. They want to commit the time. They're saying, hey, if I want to learn about backwardation, contango, and futures trader, it may take 45 minutes, and that's okay, because I'm putting in the investment. You, the viewer, are the real hero. So I'm very grateful to them.
We're going to take another quick break and be right back with more of the day's top analysis on the Real Vision Daily Briefing.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Welcome back to Real Vision's Daily Briefing. Let's get right back to the top analysis of today's markets.
Yeah, Jack, that's very well said and absolutely spot on. Jack, I should say, though, we are very grateful to you for all the work that you've done here on this show and on other shows to help us on our journey that we're all on here together at Real Vision. Jack, I have to ask you a few questions before we let you go. You've had just an incredible journey here at Real Vision. What have you learned? Give us some sense of this path that you've been on, what you've learned, and what you can share with the viewers to maybe aid them in their journey as we all kind of walk this path together.
Wow, that's a tough question, Ash. Well, I will say I did graduate from an Ivy League university with a degree in economics, and I think I received a very good and thorough education there. But I will say, like, what I've learned at Real Vision just does not compare at all. I think I've learned so much more. You know, and I think that just, you know, I've listened to a lot of interviews, and I think people who are Real Vision super fans know, like, if you listen to a lot of Real Vision interviews, the learning that you get just it increases and it compounds on itself. So how is my understanding of finance developed? I think that I've become very familiar with terms. So I'm very familiar with the shorthand. So when someone says, like, delta or, you know, moneyness or, you know, bank lending or even growth terms that people think they understand, like inflation or growth, you know, not that I don't have a complete understanding of it, but like, or think words like liquidity, which you hear all the time, but it's like, what does that actually mean? I don't think that I've fully grasped liquidity, but I say the terms is the most important thing. And then, I mean, you just have to go through topic by topic, you know, bank lending, how inflation is measured, what assets perform well during what times. I think that's, you know, part of a core of macro. So if interest rates rise, then that actually is pretty good for bank stocks because they benefit from steep yield curves. Energy stocks tend to benefit from steepening yield curves too. Why? Because are rising yields inherently good for energy stocks? No, they actually have to refinance, so they're not inherently good. But why are yields rising? Because people are selling bonds. Because when people sell bonds, yields rise. When people buy bonds, yields fall. And why would they be selling very safe paper, like a 30-year treasury bond? Because the economy is hot and they want to get on the action. So they're dumping those, you know, safe assets. So that's why yields rise. So it's not necessarily a cause, it's more of a correlation. You know, stocks are correlated to each other. Why? I don't know, but they are, you know? And so if Bank of America is up, you know, Berkshire Hathaway probably is going to be up. Wells Fargo is probably going to be up. And also just learning that, you know, it's so much, in individual stocks, it's so much more than a price to earnings ratio. And just learning how vast the future is and how sometimes that does justify a huge difference in valuation. Why some, you know, newly IPO'd cloud company can perhaps be, you know, have a price to earnings multiple like 5 times higher than IBM. And maybe that's not crazy. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say there's so much that to cover and so much we could talk about. But I'm curious, Jack, if you have any stories that resonate with you in terms of guests, live events, experiences here at Real Vision that really resonate with you and that encapsulate in many ways your journey, things that our viewers could probably connect with.
Could it be an interview?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'd say probably my interview with Professor Aswath Damodaran on valuation was one of my favorites. I really got a technical sense of discounted cash flow, which I've heard that term used a bunch. And that is one thing about Real Vision and working at Real Vision is you get very, for me, like you get broad, but like, you know, because it macro is like sort of, you know, opposed from like in the weeds, but I like in the weeds too. So I just learned so much about valuation with Aswath Damodaran. I'd also talk to Ann Stevenson Yang on Evergrande, a short selling researcher who's, you know, worked on China for many, many, many years. And you know, she was putting out reports on Evergrande as early as 2014 about how they likely didn't have as much cash in the bank as they did. So she really opened my eyes to just how business is done in China and how finance is done. And then, you know, I mean, I'll say, this is a shout out to my colleague and friend Max, who interviewed someone on a show called Zeros, which is associated with Real Vision. And actually, he interviewed Ann Stevenson Yang too. That's why I thought of it. About how there was someone in China who the company is called Faraday Future, and the founder was essentially kicked out of China. He's on a list. He can't come back to China. And China, you know, has pretty shaky financial regulatory rules. But this person is alive and well in the United States, and they have a SPAC that is de-SPAC, and it's called Faraday Future. And, you know, America is not this bastion of financial rectitude. Definitely not. So I'd say those two interviews. Sorry, I know I'm rambling a little bit.
Well, it wouldn't be 2021 if we didn't get the word SPAC in there. You know, Jack, you were going to be a superstar no matter what you did. As you say, economics degree from an Ivy League university. By the way, I should say there's hope for the rest of us. While you were doing that, I was almost certainly doing keg stands and not paying attention to markets. But Jack, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. It's been a pleasure working for you. I know that everyone here at Real Vision feels the same way. I'm looking at the comments right now from our viewers.
Yeah, what are the people saying?
I mean, you know, they're grateful to all that you've done. Lots of stuff. Lots of questions. And Jack, it's just been great to have you doing this with you. It's been a pleasure from the darkest days of the crisis through the recovery to where we are today. It's been a pleasure building this show with you.
It's been an absolute pleasure working with you, Ash. You know, you and Ed were, you know, senior people to me, and you were very talented. You helped build, I mean, not help, you really, you know, you really were the driving force behind the Daily Briefing, especially in its early days. And, you know, you could have, you know, sort of shooed me away as, oh, this kid, he's kind of like asking a lot of questions and he thinks he's, you know, he thinks he can make charts, whatever. But you actually not only, you know, didn't sort of hold me back, but you actually like encouraged me to grow and promoted, you know, me. And I'm so grateful to you and Ed for that opportunity. And also just for the Daily Briefing, which I think is a phenomenal show. And I think it was, you know, phenomenal before I started being involved with it. I think it will be phenomenal after I started being involved with it. I will add, though, that it's definitely changed so much. You know, it was sort of forged in chaos. It was born in the cauldron of the COVID crisis. And the actual beginning of it, of the Daily Briefing intro, the news wrap, initially, this is dark to say, but it was about COVID infections and COVID deaths. And now it's, you know, morphed into something completely different. So I think the Daily Briefing, as much as it's a staple in people's lives, I think it is something that is not static and is always changing.
Jack, I appreciate you saying that. By the way, the reason I gave you such a broad leeway was just pure naked self-interest. I sort of suspected that someday I'd end up working for you. So build the good relationship now.
Yeah. Well, I have people who we've hired at Real Vision who are interns who are phenomenally capable, who I have the same self-interest out of, and I've supported them out of my pure greed.
Jack, we've got a wrap here, but I'm going to give it to you. Last word, 30 seconds, final thoughts.
Oh, man. You know, I always joke with my coworker and friend, Nick Correa, when we do the exchange on the Real Vision Exchange, we do this show, The Breakdown, which unfortunately may no longer happen. He always asks this question, what are your final thoughts at the end? And it's my least favorite question because it's so hard to answer. I will just want to reiterate my gratitude to the Real Vision audience, to everyone I work with, to the guests. And, you know, I just want to say that I'm not leaving the world of macro. Like Real Vision's is, I'm addicted to macro, and I'm, you know, my journey with Real Vision is come to a close, unfortunately, but I will be in the macro world for sure.
Yeah. Thanks for watching the Real Vision Daily Briefing. On tomorrow's show, I'll be hosting Real Vision co-founder Rao Pal. Same time, same place. In the meantime, you can come chat with us on Real Vision's Exchange. Thanks for watching, everyone. And thank you again, Jack.
Thank you, Ash. And thank you, everyone. It's been an absolute pleasure.